Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another APS market call. I'm Steve Abrahams. In the last 10 years or so, a couple of things have changed in an important market that finances healthcare and apartment buildings pretty much across the United States, and that's the market for Ginnie Mae project loans. The market has grown from $41 billion in the teeth of the crisis to $116 billion today, and that's given investors much more exposure. And many investors have realized that the prevailing and somewhat odd convention of evaluating this market with a few constant prepayment projections, or CPJ series, just doesn't work that well. Prepayments have varied a lot over the last 10 years. In fact, they've swung from lows around 5 CPR to highs around 40 CPR. So the cash flows vary, and the market really needs a smarter model to capture that. Luckily, the information that we might need for building a good model has improved, and a lot more of it is available. Among other things, we now have better data for estimating property appreciation, better data for tax credit status, and other good pieces of data at the loan level. And here at Amherst, we've used that better data to build a better model. And we've then taken that better model and we put it to work in an analytics system that makes a broad set of interest rate and property price projections and then sends the model out into the future to give us estimates of how project loans might prepay or default. The result, a very new set of option-adjusted estimates of spreads, option costs, duration, convexity, and so on. What we find is that this model says some really striking things about the state of the Ginnie Mae project loan market. Among other things, prepayment speeds vary substantially across different loans and the structured transactions backed by them, and the pattern does not necessarily look like a CPJ projection. The picture of relative value within a deal varies a lot too, with good risk-adjusted spreads and longer tranches and in the interest-only or IO classes. The longer classes almost surely benefit from burnout or a steady slowing in the prepayment response over time. And the IO class benefits from project loan prepayment penalties, another key feature of this market, and those penalties typically go to the IO class. The other thing that we've observed is that relative value differs a lot across deals, and that's going to be partly because of the structure and partly because the underlying project loan features differ too. Some deals are backed by loans with more favorable prepayment penalties or smaller loan balances or properties with more or less appreciation. And all of that adds up to a striking picture of relative value. So deals that, for example, might look similar on the surface suddenly look a lot different after a model highlights some of these differences between them. So today, we want to highlight the most important features of the new APS model. So we're joined by Joshin Wang, who's the lead modeler on project loans here. And we also want to touch on the ways the model is being used to structure and trade project loans. So we're joined by John Teston, who's the lead structurer for project loans on our trading desk. So to start, Josh, let me turn to you and ask you to lay out the approach we took to capturing the important elements of prepayments and defaults in this market.
Sure. Thank you, Steve, for have a brief introduction of the model as well as the market. Here, I will drill down more into the detailed components of the model. But before I do that, let me say that not only there are differences in loan characteristics across different deals, even among deals, there's a lot of great dispersion in terms of WACC, or in terms of penalty structure, home price appreciation experience, etc. So this model where we are running is loan level model that's running on different, running a Monte Carlo simulation. This helps us to better capture the risk profile of the true nature of the deal. Okay, next, I'm going to talk more, drill down into the components of the model. As Steve was saying, there's a lot of variation in terms of speed with the rate in, different rate incentives. So we feel like a proper S-curve-based refinance model is appropriate here. When we're thinking about rate incentive, what we're thinking about? Of course, the borrower has their gross WAC, and then we'll consider what is the primary rate they're looking at when they go to refi. For the historical time series, we use the historical origination WAC of all of the collateral as the primary rate for the refinance. But we do filter to include refinance loans only. Basically, we exclude all the construction loans because historically, construction loans tend to have higher WAC than the refinance paper, and that's not the rate they are looking for when you refinance. We took this historical time series and see that it's very well correlated with the rates market, so we have modeled it as a function of different tenors on the curve and projected going forward use this model. And then the second piece of rate incentive, which is the most important feature, arguably, about the Gini project loan market, is the penalty structure. When you have a lot of penalty points, say you have 10 points of penalty points, even if you have 100 bips of rate incentive, it still takes you, give or take, 10 years of interest savings to recoup the penalty that you're paying. So it significantly discouraged the borrower from prepaying. That said, the borrower will still prepay if they are given enough rate incentives. So what does it mean? It means like, for instance, with the rate sell-off, at the very, for the recent originations, they have very low rate incentive already as rate selling off, and they still have very high penalty points to pay. So they're very slow at the beginning, but as time pass by, their penalty points decreases. They'll start going to pay faster. One thing to mention is that the HUD do have the authority to override penalty points if they seem it's to be in the interest of the government. But recently, in the recent history, they have really done do so. There are other things that can impact the rate incentive. For instance, there's different mortgage insurance premium. In 2012 and 2016, there are two different MI changes. The main change, I would say, they start differentiating the mortgage insurance premium that's paid for properties with or without a low-income housing tax credit. If you have collateral that's originated before that, you can potentially face a different rate incentive.
Okay, that's great, Josh. And now, I know that you've mentioned to me on a number of occasions the importance of loan size, something that even residential prepayment models tend to find. And there are other factors as well. Could you touch a little bit on that?
Of course. For the refinance, loan size is one very big effect, as the transaction cost is not proportional to the loan size. So on a percentage basis, it's lower for the higher loan size paper to pay for the transaction cost and more dollar savings in an absolute amount. So we do see that loan size, higher loan size paper do tend to prepay much faster than a loan size paper. Other important factors including property price appreciation. When a property price appreciates, they're more likely to prepay with the possibility of taking out a larger loan. Or when the property price depreciates, it's getting harder for the borrower to qualify for new mortgages. Even through the streamlined refinance program, there are still underwriting requirements like the SCR. It will make it harder to qualify if you have a depreciation. Other factors include, say, loan purpose. We found construction loans prepay faster. Property type also matters. When we see the rural housing collateral through USDA collateral, they tend to prepay slower. Also, I also have find the tax credit status seems to matter as well. They tend to prepay slower. I think the investor are trying to avoid the risk of losing credits.
Okay, and how about other things which I guess are commonly part of these models, like age, and related things, I guess, burnout and things of that sort, or other factors?
Age is very important factor. As age increases, loan seasons, the speed will go up until the loan is fully seasoned. And if there's a lockout period in the penalty structure, then when they get out of the lockout time period and there's incentive, then the property is much likely to prepay because there's pent-up demand. As the loan seasons more and they may slow down in terms of speed if they're just going through similar incentives. Basically, that's the burnout effect that you're referring to. Basically, if you have passed on the re-incentive, you decide not to refi before, it's less likely for you to refi again right now. But this burnout effect is decreases or subdued if you have hit historical low rate, or in other words, historically high incentive, then you are less burnout and then the speed can increase again. This especially will be interesting for some weird, unusual penalty point structures. If you have, say, 10, 10, 3, 2, 1, when it drops, the penalty points drop from 10 points to 3 points, all of a sudden you start to have more incentive and you will see an increase in speed significantly. The other thing that I think in the refinance model that's worth mentioning is the RR program, which is the streamlined refinance program in this space. And when it came into place in 2013, it makes everything prepay faster. Not only that, it also changed certain features, importance, or relative relationship with each other. Because they have significantly decreased the transaction cost, the larger loan size versus the smaller loan size, the speed differential has decreased.
Okay, fabulous. So that kind of covers the refi side of the picture. But obviously, interest rates go up, and in today's market, there is a lot of these loans that really don't have plausible refinancing incentives. So what happens then?
So for that, still it's twofold. One is the voluntary and one is the involuntary. The voluntary, we also have a turnover piece of the model. One of the most important will be age, because you need to be seasoned enough to prepay. And another big part of it will be locking effect. Consider that FHA loans are assumable. If you are very, very out of the money, the new buyer is more likely to assume the loan instead of paying it off, then it will not result in a prepayment. But you might ask, why would you still see loans that's really out of the money but they're still prepaying? I think this locking effect needs to be crossed with property price appreciation. When you have very high appreciation, the original loan represents a smaller percentage of the total price. So the new buyer needs to put down a lot of equity to buy the property, make them less likely to assume the loan but take out a new loan so that they can put down less equity. Other factors that impacting the refinance piece can also matter. For instance, the rural housing, we find it to prepay, to turn over slower as well. And tax credit still matters. I think the investors are more in for the tax credit. They're not into selling the property. And the other part of it will be the involuntary piece of it. The defaults. It's very important because it impacts all your penalty points received. We have found the PLD curve is a little bit too punitive for the recent experience, but we do find the same spirit as the PLD curve. Basically, based on the age, at first you will have more defaults, and then it start to burn credit burnout, basically. It will also decrease over time. And intuitively, property price depreciation matters. And then larger loan size will default more, and construction loans also default more, given that they have more uncertainty involved around the project. I think that covers most of the important portion of the model so far.
Okay, that's tremendous. And obviously, there's a lot more detail, which is covered in the write-up. But let's, for the moment, swing away from the model itself and focus a little bit on just some initial observations on what it does to security valuation. So one of the most important things that it's doing, especially in today's market with relatively high rates on new project loans and with most old loans below par, is that projected prepayment speeds fall well below the traditional 15 CPJ. In fact, if I'm remembering correctly what we saw in the model, you only get 15 CPJ when you have loans that to some extent are in the money and have refinancing incentive sufficient to help them start to overcome some of their potentially remaining prepayment penalties they have to pay. So if you look at newer deals, weighted average lives are longer, and what you're seeing for those of you looking at the slides is an example of that. There's a deal, recent deal, chosen for no special reason, GNR 2018-161. That has a weighted average coupon on the underlying loans of roughly 4%. And even though the current market rate for new project loans is just slightly higher than that, let's call it 4.15, these new loans obviously carry their initial heavy penalties, and you can see what the model views as the likely long-term prepayment speeds, which in the neighborhood of 6.6 CDR for the life of the asset. You can see the impact on average life. The average life extends 4 years or more from the 15 CPJ assumption, and obviously, since these are securities trading below par, their spread to either the swap or treasury curve tends to fall, and yield tends to drop a little bit as well. What's worth noting in this particular example is the impact of the slower prepayments on the IO class. That's the very last class in this deal. Intuition from residential MBS might be that slower prepayments are just unequivocally good. But in a project loan, voluntary prepayment penalties generally go to the IO. So slower prepayments mean a slower capture of the penalties. So there's a trade-off there. And in project loan deals, the slower recapture of the penalties tends to dominate. So spreads and yields on the IO in particular drop. The other interesting thing that's worth noting is that there's a pattern in option-adjusted spreads within a deal. In general, longer classes and classes that are more sensitive to prepayments and defaults have a higher OAS. Some of that may be structure, and some may be in the pattern of prepayments. So, for example, you'll notice in shorter classes that they may have high spreads if you assume reasonably stable rates, and that would be captured by the zero volatility OAS, but then they tend to have some pretty healthy option costs, which gives you a net lower OAS. The shorter class, for example, may be absorbing the immediate impact of changes in rates, while longer classes have some protection. So longer classes also may be benefiting from burnout in the collateral. I wouldn't want to overgeneralize that this is always the case, but I think an OAS model allows us to start asking these questions. And then the other thing I'd observe is that there's a pattern in OAS across deals as well. Again, you can see two examples here. That's always going to be a function of both structure and any differences in the underlying collateral. But the value here is that you can take two classes that might look very similar on a CPJ or yield table, and you can run OAS and start to detect the differences in structure, the differences in collateral, or even more subtly, the way that structure and collateral ultimately interact. So there's a lot of value in adopting a dynamic structure and option-adjusted spread analysis to look at these securities that clearly have some cash flow variability at risk. Okay, let's now move closer to where the action is, and that would be the trading desk. So I want to turn to John Teston for a moment. And John, I know that structuring and trading has just started to use the new model, and it's important to give a little color on today's market and today's structure, because that definitely plays into the best ways to use the model. So maybe you can take us through some of that.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. So since I started trading and structuring project loans 6 years ago, the market has grown a lot. For example, current yearly volume is around $17 billion now and has significantly ramped up since 2012. But let's just touch on structure a little bit. So for those of you that are relatively new to this market, the generic structure that we normally see is where you have front sequentials, you know, which range from 3 to 4.5 years, a middle cash flow that generally ranges between 9 and 13 years, and either a Z or a long payer, depending on what the dealer wants to do and what the preference is in the market. Then, of course, there's the IO, which is interesting, as Steve touched on, because it typically gets 100% of the prepaid penalties. So real quick, for anyone not familiar, the call protections on project loans are almost always 10 years and start at 10% in the first year and decline by 1% every year after that. So I would say the structure, you know, has generally remained consistent post-crisis, with a few changes to things like the front sequentials, where guys will ask for certain average life profiles or higher or lower coupons depending on the rate environment. But here's what I've seen in the market recently. So at the end of 2017 and into the first half of 2018, a lot of the short front bonds were 96 or 97 handle dollars. So one development we've seen more recently is a shift since late summer, where more buyers are requesting coupons that are closer to par. Obviously, these changing bond profiles have an impact on new collateral production. So since late August, you will notice also that deal WACs have increased approximately 30 basis points as collateral spreads widened to accommodate the investor's request for higher coupons. An advantage of the higher coupon bonds is that they have a flatter return profile that's less levered to prepayments and perform better under stress scenarios. So just to give you an idea, a common stress scenario that guys look at is running a bond to between 5 and 7 CPJ. Now, I should caveat this by saying some investors do prefer to have the optionality and upside that results from prepays, and request the lower dollar price bonds that price much wider at 15 CPJ. So it really depends on your view there and you know, what you want to do with your particular bond. But since it's a zero-sum game, when front bonds are created with the higher coupons, the new production aisle buyer is left with a thinner coupon and bonds that are more levered to prepayments. So as a result, we've also seen spreads on the new issue IOs widen at 15 CPJ, where things were just a few months ago. So you're probably asking yourself, well, how do I use the model to my advantage? So given what I said about bonds being levered to either prepays or carry, this is where opportunities to use our model come into play. You can strategically position bonds that are either more levered to prepays or bonds that perform better at extension, depending on the underlying collateral, which is what we rely on the model to show us. So this is obviously dependent on your rate view and how you want to position your portfolio. But for those of you who are relatively new to the Ginnie IO space, here's a few things to consider when you're looking at underlying collateral. So you definitely want to focus on WAC dispersion, prepay penalty cliffs that may be on certain pools within the deal, such as 5 years at 10% and then dropping to 5%, non-standard prepays, such as 5% declining to 1% over 5 years, since there's usually a reason that borrowers request this prepay structure. High top 10 concentrations, call it, you know, above 70%, just to limit your exposure to, you know, certain loans within the collateral pool. And portfolio loans from the same borrower, which is something that is often overlooked. So you can identify these portfolio loans, or at least we've noticed that you can identify them by consecutive pool numbers that have the same loan characteristics. such as call protections, you know, same gross and net rate, things like that. And, you know, there's a high likelihood that when the borrower does prepay, they may prepay them all at the same time. So it's just something to be wary of. So when I run bonds, I often notice situations where, you know, yield profiles to static prepay assumptions look similar across different bonds. But our model allows us to see these same bonds through a different lens by adjusting for things like price appreciation, call protections, tax components, et cetera, the things that Joshine mentioned earlier. Not only are these details captured within the model's speed and default projections, but through OAS and option cost as well. So a bond that might appear less favorable on a yield table might actually be the better bond and vice versa. So on more than one occasion, you know, I've seen IOs that look reasonable on a yield table, but our model doesn't like them. After digging into the collateral a little further, we can kind of see what's driving those assumptions that otherwise wouldn't be picked up through either Bloomberg or Intex if you're looking at the collateral there. So the disparity between a bond that shows well in a yield table and the model's results is a perfect example of the model capturing nuances in either the collateral or structure that YT might miss. So it's, you know, it's useful to really look at these bonds through a model in addition to Bloomberg, just to help you gauge, you know, how different pieces of the underlying collateral are running. Another general way to use our model is when looking at BWICs or offers. I think it's helpful to run a few bonds through it to determine projected average lives on what's being shown rather than seeing them all to 15 CPJ and guessing on the right speed to run. So that's pretty much it from my side.
Okay. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. So at this point, we have a few minutes left, and we can start taking some questions. Initially, there's two ways you can ask questions. You can either submit them through the conference calling GoToWebinar app. I believe there's a place where you can write in those questions. We'll read a few off. We already do have a couple in. So let's keep going through that, and then we can briefly open it to questions over the phone in a minute or two. But one question we get is, what percent of penalties has HUD waived? I don't know if we have an answer to that one.
I can take that. Recently, Ginnie Mae has published a runtime tape to show what is the actual penalty point that was paid by the borrower when they prepay. And for the 2017-2018, we are only counting a handful of them. It's really very de minimis amount of penalty points has been waived recently.
Yeah, and typically when HUD does waive penalties, it's generally to help out a distressed borrower, you know, so they're not just waiving penalties for the sake of it. I mean, it's if the borrower is in trouble, you know, we'd rather not default the loan if they're in the money to refi. They'll typically work out some kind of a situation with HUD and the originator.
So anybody who wants to ask a question, you can open your line by pressing 4-star. If you wouldn't mind, please give your name and your organization. For those who are thinking about asking a question, I'll kind of jump in front for a moment and ask Josh, and a question that I know has come up before. We get questions about construction loans, why they seem to come hot right out of the gate, even after they've converted to project loans, and you have a really interesting take on that.
I think there's a couple reasons why construction loans are faster. For one, they have a lock-off time period, that they have a construction time period, and even for the project loan not converted from construction, just project loan coming out of lockout, it will be faster if you have a re-incentive. Second, if you're thinking about construction loan, some of the borrowers are really interested in developing the project and doing renovation, less interested in maintaining and running a project. Their entire business model could be just developing the project. So after the construction period, they are more likely to sell the property. The third thing, I think, is because construction property, when we are calculating the price appreciation. We're counting at the beginning of the construction time period, the market is pricing at X, and at the end of the construction time period, it's at Y, so it has an increase of, say, 20% of appreciation or whatever the number is for the market. But because this is a construction project, the people can, the construction itself is adding value. Instead of saying the beta of the market is, say, 20% of price increase, for the particular property, it could be more than that, much more than that, resulting in, like, in a more higher home price, home property appreciation kind of scenario.
Okay. We're continuing to get questions via the web. So one question we're getting is, what does the model show for bonds like 2013, which I guess are paying at very low speeds? You know, is there some expectation of HPA or NOI growth? I don't know if we've observed slow speeds in the 2013 paper.
Yeah, we might need an example bond on that one to,
okay,
to run.
All right. We're going to then, I think, pass on addressing that one directly. For the person who asked that question, please follow up with us. We can take an individual bond. We can see if there's something happening there. And then second, I guess there's a question about how the model did for back testing, for example, pre-crisis vintages. There was a rapid uptick in prepayments that occurred in, I suspect what the questioner is asking about is prepayments that occurred in 2011 and then in 2012 and 13. But I believe that was the introduction of the Streamline program, or could there be another explanation?
Yeah, in the 2013 time, well, in 2011, 2012, the market rate is hitting lows, so there's a speed up in terms of prepayment speed, and in, you can see there is a very huge spike in 2013 area when the first Streamline program was introduced to it. So yes, model is capturing all those different episodes. It is applied to all the collateral. It's applying to any time after, say, 2006.
Okay. Do we have any questioners on the line that would like to ask something? You can press 4-star if you'd like to ask your question over the phone. Okay. Well, we don't have any more questions online, but nevertheless, we remain open to any of your questions going forward. I just want to remind you that everyone should have received at some point, I believe the initial announcement went out on January 22nd, the publication that goes into detail on the model, entitled Prepayments, Defaults, and Value in Ginnie Mae Project Loans. If you don't have a copy of that, please contact your APS sales representative and we'll make sure it gets in your hands. For clients that would like to see how this model views their current holdings, we would be more than happy to take in your project loan portfolio and turn around a nice report showing you the various option-adjusted statistics and how that might compare with a standard 15 CPJ picture of your securities. So thank you for your time this afternoon. On behalf of Josh and John, we want to thank you, and this concludes our call for today. Goodbye.